Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for our dive into the news the last couple of weeks. Lots has been going on, and we're going to talk about some of the news stories in a few minutes. With me this morning is a man who's been watching The X-Files on repeat since we last gathered 2 weeks ago and talked about UFOs, our National Director, John Stevens. Hello, John.
Hi, Phil. I never actually watched The X-Files first time round, let alone this time round.
Oh, what a mistake. You're missing
Doctor
out,
Doctor Who in my childhood, that's it. And Blake 7, that'll do.
Very good, very good. And a man who is exercised by the fact that Arsenal have two goalkeepers, Adrian Reynolds, our head
of national defence. I've been watching the Ryder
Cup. Have you as well?
Yeah, there we go.
Excellent.
Is that an indication of how vulnerable their defence is?
You know nothing about football. You are not qualified to comment.
That's why I'm asking the question.
Excellent, excellent. Moving very swiftly on. Adrian, you have just returned, though, from a weekend away serving a church just past. Tell us what you're doing there.
Trinity Church, Oxford, last weekend in a place called Ledbury, which is in Herefordshire, where they had their weekend away. Great time to spend time with kind of the core of the church, really, in the centre of Oxford, so lots of students. But before most of the students return, working with a lot of the people there who are leading small groups and student ministry. Yeah, a really happy time and great to hear a church flourishing. They've had lots of challenges. We've spoken before and we've put an article up actually on the website about just LGBT struggles and pressures that there are in Oxford and building pressures that churches have. And they have all of those kinds of struggles being a relatively new church plant. But great really to see them thriving and in good heart. And the gospel going out. Great to meet people who had just become Christians. You know, what a thrill that is.
Fantastic. And John, yesterday was our London gatherings, about 75, 80 leaders gathered at Stockwell Baptist Church. That was a great time yesterday. Graham Bynan spoke, I think. And this weekend, we got the deadline for the next early bird pass for the leaders conference. And we're all moving towards that now, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. It's great. We've got over 880 people booked. We'd love more. Fantastic venue in the Winter Gardens in Blackpool. Plenty of kind of accommodation at all kinds of levels, easily accessible, great range of speakers. We're thinking about the whole issue of justice. What does it mean for God to be just? How does that work out in our salvation? How does that work out in society? What's the particular role of the church? This is a really live issue in the
culture. Are we just going woke, John?
No.
Sounds like it.
Well, if you think woke means thinking about those issues, we're going woke. Right. But if you think, actually, we've got to address the question in culture and society and the church, what does God's demand for justice mean and how does that work out? Right. And in a culture that's asking those questions all the time, I think it's really important for us to think biblically about that. Yeah. We know that across the FIEC and across evangelicalism, there's a spectrum of opinions. There's a spectrum of opinions as to what justice means, what it will look like in practice, and indeed, what's the right way to achieve that within wider society? So we're not wanting to say, here is the definitive FIEC line on this. But actually, as we think about how we bring the gospel to bear in a culture that is asking really big questions about justice, oppression, fairness, equality, it's absolutely appropriate for us to think, what does the Bible say about that? And how do we communicate into that culture? That's what we're trying to do. Our aim is to help people to be able to think more effectively about it so that they actually don't respond with just a superficial knee-jerk, oh, that's just terrible wokery, or leaping onto a social justice bandwagon. Right. But we think biblically about it.
Well, you can save money on your tickets if you buy by this coming Saturday, 30th of September. You can still get tickets after that, but they are slightly more expensive. And we're really looking forward to gathering in Blackpool. What you've said there, John, leads us really helpfully into our first news story that we're going to be discussing today. So Home Secretary Suella Braverman did a speech in the States where she basically said multiculturalism has failed, and she questioned whether the UN 1951 Refugee Convention is fit for the modern age. Her comments were rejected by many. Even the Prime Minister wouldn't kind of back them when he was interviewed about it later. There are, even right now, challenges for us to think about in terms of integration, in terms of the way immigration works. We've talked previously about the small boats. How can church leaders respond wisely to these kind of matters? Because they're polarizing opinions, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think she's raised questions that are really important and, again, are massively significant at the moment. There is no doubt that there is a refugee crisis around the world. That's partly a result of oppressive regimes that are mistreating people. That's a result of actually in the modern world, people can travel more easily. It's a result of kind of communication, phones, people's ability to be able to understand what's happening. So there are more people who are on the move, displaced because of kind of war, oppression, injustice than there have been. So, and lots of countries are struggling with that. Europe in particular is struggling that with refugees coming in from North Africa. That's true in Italy, that's true in Greece, that's true in Spain, that's true kind of in our own country with the small boat. So this is a massive kind of global challenge. And actually most of the displacement of refugees isn't actually in Europe at all. It's in countries in like Turkey and countries in Africa in which large numbers of refugees have kind of moved. So it's right to recognize this is a difficult issue. And I think there's a lot of public frustration and politicians are finding it very difficult to solve, which tells us something. There is no simplistic, easy answer to this. I'm slightly reluctant to say the fundamental problem is the 1951 convention. And some of the things that were said, I think, are not helpful. So that convention was put together to help people fleeing genuine persecution, and it gives people the right to flee, the right to be able to have asylum. It's worth remembering that the vast majority of migration to the UK is not refugees. It is actually managed migration and permitted migration. There are something like 600,000 migrants coming to the UK every year, net migration figures. The vast majority of those are legal migration. The number of asylum seekers, refugees, is about 80,000. So to get it in perspective, if you think migration is a problem, it's not really primarily because of the refugee crisis. So the idea there are 780 million refugees just waiting to come just doesn't reflect the reality of what is happening. I think that her comments about how we understand persecution, one of the things she seemed to be saying is that actually we're interpreting persecution too widely, so that we include discrimination, people who are, say, gay, women who face discrimination in their countries. She seems to be saying that they shouldn't be allowed to seek
presumably, sort of we might add Christians to that list.
Well, it's interesting she didn't mention religion there. Lots of people who come to the UK, many of our churches will have people who are from Iran who are Christians, who have a real risk of discrimination, and those churches are supporting them. Actually, Suella Braverman's idea that sort of discrimination that restricts your life is something you should have to put up with could be applied to large numbers of Christians who've sought asylum in the UK. So I think things have changed. What is persecution? Do we think that's only physical harm, imprisonment, or do we think that actually being put under restrictions on your life that prevent you being able to exercise freedoms is sufficient reason to be able to kind of seek refugee status? So I think it's a massive problem. I'm not sure that just changing the legal structure is going to actually solve the problem. The problem is fundamentally the ways that sort of people suffer under tyrannical, oppressive regimes and under kind of world poverty. And that's not going to go away, whatever way you change the law. And of course, in relation to the refugees, the biggest problem is not the convention, but actually once people come, it's very difficult to return them. Because in many cases, countries that they've come from do not want to accept them back. And there is a real risk of harm to those people. So you can change the legal framework and the rights, but when it comes down to it, it's extraordinarily difficult to return people to oppressive, persecuting, discriminating kind of regimes. And I don't actually think the public would stand for it if they saw in the end that that's what our courts and systems started to do.
Adrian, how can church leaders speak wisely into this? Because it's a topic that polarizes people and it's whipped up in the media. And we know certain newspapers will take certain positions. There'll be people in our churches who are drinking at that cultural well. How do you speak wisely to people
about it? Well, we're pastors before we're politicians. I think that's always important to remember. So we might have political views on acceptable levels of migration and what we think about that. We might vote different ways. That might be a key factor in how we vote personally. But we are pastors first of local churches. And local churches should be welcoming to people who come through the door, whatever their story, actually. And I think there are lots and lots of FIC churches who are doing great work in this area, actually, who are providing a warm welcome to people from other cultures and countries who are fleeing for all and moving for all kinds of different reasons. And I think it's striking going around churches, meeting the number of Iranian people there are in our churches, converts really thriving, actually, even though sometimes they're being very badly treated here, as well as, you know, obviously they're fleeing terrible persecution, but they've found life here difficult. And we've seen that, I think, with Ukraine. We've seen that with Hong Kong. Lots of churches have a large number of Ukrainians. And actually just in the last few years, hearing about how churches have been transformed because the culture is changing rapidly. And people who have come from overseas are coming to the church, are providing actually a life and a vitality and a challenge that's been really exciting and energizing. I heard about one church that has been in a very historically white area and is completely having to rethink how it does church as the area changes and be welcoming and involve people of from all different places in leadership and all those kinds of questions. So I think it's a really exciting challenge to be wrestling with as a church. Spent a long time in East London. We had 56 nationalities in the church. Loved it. I really miss that, actually. So I think actually we should be thankful that many churches are doing what churches should do, which is to be welcoming to those who come. I think beyond that, then we need to be helping our people and teaching our people what is right and fair. I was just, as I walked into church this morning, I was listening to James, just kind of on an audio Bible, and just struck again by just how there is to be no favoritism in church. So actually, even if you think the person who is rich has got there, you know, in the wrong way, or the person who is poor is, you know, responsible for their own downfall, actually you don't show any favoritism in church. And I think we've got to teach people that. And we've got to teach people fairness. We've got to teach people in some way to decouple some of the political views they hold from some of the Christian views they hold, and just wrap everything up together so that they become these sort of belligerent people on all kinds of different issues. So yeah, I think the gospel in local church calls us to be fair. It calls us to be generous. It calls us to be welcoming, kind, compassionate, just, all those sorts of things and more.
And I think it's really important that we recognise the problem's not primarily on our doorstep. The problem is in the places where the kind of persecution and oppression is occurring. And actually, as Christians, we've got a responsibility to care about that. And in as far as we are able to be involved in that. So, I mean, you see that in the Bible, don't you? The church can't do everything. But even a small church in the early days of the church could gather a collection for believers in places where they were suffering persecution or discrimination. That's exactly what Paul's collection for the Christians in kind of Judea was all about. The rich Gentile Christians who enjoyed a measure of freedom were basically giving to support the poor Christians who were experiencing a large measure of kind of discrimination. And of course, remember that at various points, the Christians had to flee from Jerusalem under persecution. So there was a genuine care for believers in places in which persecution was occurring. And I think we can raise the eyes of our congregations to do that. I remember when I was a kind of almost new Christian in the late 1980s, we were sending Bibles to Christians in Russia who were under kind of oppression. We were regularly, you know, people were writing to Amnesty International and others, making the case for people who were suffering kind of religious kind of persecution. And I think at one level, we need to be willing to do that. I'm very grateful for organizations around the world that campaign for religious freedom for everyone, that in a sense, remove some of that discrimination that causes people to sort of, in a sense, want to flee elsewhere. So I think caring for those that are suffering, particularly in the Christian family. I think supporting the Christian agencies that are working in the countries where they are actually dealing with millions of refugees in camps and elsewhere, that in a sense is where there's a massive need for support. And obviously, of course, praying for God's justice to be done in the world. Those seem to me things that we ought to do rather than thinking this is just a sort of a problem on our doorstep. There's actually a bigger responsibility we have.
Phil, there's something else going on here as well, I think, which is not so much about the issue itself, but about collective responsibility. So the Home Secretary is a member of the cabinet, and it certainly appears as though, she said she had her speech signed off by 10 Downing Street, but it's interesting that when Rishi Sunak was interviewed yesterday...
He wouldn't go into it, would he?
He wouldn't go into it. You know, she singled out Leicester, just up the road from us, as a particular place of difficulty.
The Bishop of Leicester pushed back really strongly against
that.
Well,
and she must know that Rishi Sunak's mother comes from Leicester. Yeah. So you kind of wonder what exactly is going on. You know, the cabinet is supposed to exercise collective responsibility. In many ways, there are similarities to plural leadership in church. You know, it's not just that people have a responsibility for their areas. They do work collectively as a cabinet. And actually, we want leaders, and leaders should in the church work in that way. And this morning, remarkably, her own ministry, the Home Office, rejecting her claims, which is an extraordinary bit of, you know, disassembling, really, to say actually that what she's saying is not right. So I just think there's a great lesson there for leaders as how we make plural leadership work in church. It's not easy. Mm. It's not straightforward. And people will have strong views on certain subjects. But actually, part of serving the church, having that servant heart, sometimes is putting our own views, making them secondary, and speaking collectively as a group of leaders. I've had that experience when I've had to stand up in a church meeting to defend something I didn't particularly agree with in terms of just a minor decision we were taking. But that is how collective responsibility works. And I think we do need to learn from that as well as be reflecting on the whole question of migration.
So move on. I want to talk about the other political party, the Labour Party. Do you, you've got something
you want to say? Hang on, there are other political parties in the UK.
Thank you for correcting me.
Please, we'll read.
John's giving me the eyes. He wants to pick up something we just said.
I want to come back on Suella on something else, actually. I mean, we've talked about the refugee problem, but actually a whole other thing she raised was the whole question of multiculturalism. And she said that multiculturalism had failed. And I think that's a very important different issue. So multiculturalism is actually created not just by refugees, but actually by legal migration of large numbers of people who come from a different culture and make their home in a country. And she seemed to be saying that multiculturalism had failed, which is sort of a very strong thing to say. I mean, in Britain, we've seen significant migration from the 1950s. So 1950, only about 1% of the population was from an ethnic minority. And then there have been waves of migration. Since then, again and again, when that's happened, the response has been a kind of a hostility to the impact that will have on the culture. So I've been reading a history of Britain in the 60s and the 70s. Enoch Powell, notoriously using racist inflammatory language, questioned mass immigration. And actually, as I've read it, it wasn't so much that he was racist, but he was making exactly this same point, that if you have a large number of people that come from a different culture, inevitably the culture has to change, that you will not be the same people, you will not have the same identity because culture will shift. We've seen that again. I mean, in many ways, the Kenyan Asians who came in 1970s, again, there was similar opposition to the multiculturalism and the impact that would have. And that's occurring again with the current kind of high levels of migration. And at one level, she says multiculturalism doesn't work. Not clear exactly what she means by that. She is obviously saying the problem here is people who don't accommodate to the culture. But the challenge, I think, is that whenever you have people, a significant number of people who come from a different culture, ultimately the culture itself changes and has to adjust. So there are only really two ways of dealing with people coming from a whole variety of different cultures. One is a form of apartheid in which they live totally separate lives. And that can either be done by kind of legal restriction or actually by just communities choosing not to interact at all. Or inevitably, over time, what happens is you develop a blended culture in which actually the culture changes because you have very significant inflow. So what do we mean by multiculturalism failing? Seems to me Britain has accommodated a remarkable change since the 1950s from people who've come from very, very different backgrounds, and they've enriched national life.
Yeah, most of it is for the better, hugely.
But there's no doubt that an understanding of what it meant to be British, a British character, a British identity, has changed because of mass migration. Now, actually, that's a fundamental biblical principle. That's exactly what we see in the Bible. As the church grows, the church begins as a mono-ethnic Jewish community. And as the gospel goes out, it begins to reach people from different cultures, Samaritans, God-fearers, Romans, Greeks, pagans. Mm. And the church begins to become a melting pot of people who come in from a whole variety of different kind of cultures. And actually, at points, people don't like that. Mm. You read the New Testament, and some of the Jewish communities do not like the change that is bringing about to their community. Some churches break off and separate to keep a cultural identity. But the long-term consequence of the gospel is a blending of cultures and the creating of a new culture, which doesn't really reflect any of those that were there beforehand. It's quite interesting that even the point of shifting to the language of calling people Christians represents the recognition of a new culture. Mm. And actually practices change. So Paul in Corinthians can talk about practices over, for example, women in church, dress, codes, behaviors. I mean, he basically starts talking about how the church is creating a new culture, which is everywhere. And I think in a way, the church was constantly wrestling with this question of multiculturalism. How do we bring people in from a variety of cultural backgrounds? Mm. And do they keep their identity or do they create a new culture? Do they become united? Do they assimilate? And it's never the case of just simply assimilating a culture. It's actually the culture is changed as that diversity begins to impact. Actually, the Bible tells us that takes an immense amount of effort and a long time to accomplish. Mm. But actually, it's the dominating issue of the New Testament is how do we bring together Jewish and Gentile believers to create this kind of new culture? It's a work that's constantly in progress. So I think this whole issue of multiculturalism and how you cope with people from a variety of different cultural backgrounds is a big social issue, but it's actually a really big issue in churches, not just over issues of ethnicity, language, but over issues of taste, culture, class. We're constantly working at how do we meld a new culture out of multicultures.
Thank you. Let me rephrase my introduction to the next section. Let's talk about the main party of opposition, the Labour Party. There we are. Excellent. I've corrected that. Some stuff on the front page of the papers this week about private schools. And if Labour come to power in the next election, thought that they might remove charitable status from private schools. They've now rowed back on that and they're not going to. I just wanted to talk about that because I think it's got implications for churches. Is that right, Adrian?
Well, in a way, and in a way not. So this could be
all churches are charities, right?
Most churches are charities. They don't have to be, but churches are charities. They want to be organisations in and of themselves. As I go around and talk to church leaders, one of the things that I hear expressed relatively frequently is, I think as the country changes, we'll lose our charitable status. Now, John has got a view on that. We'll hear that in a moment.
Well, that was in the manifesto at the 2019 general election.
Was it?
Yeah, okay. Jeremy Corbyn.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was sitting around the table and we were saying, if Labour gets into power today, FIC, our church will lose a charitable
status. Legally, it might not be a very strong argument, but it feels like, maybe that's one of the things we could lose. And obviously, we benefit from that. We benefit from that in terms of gift aid, for example, and the benefits, the financial benefits. And there are other ways, too, that people benefit. So I think there is some, there's kind of an underlying concern as Christians get more marginalized, will we feel that in our bank accounts as well as in other ways? I think what's quite interesting about this decision by the Labour Party to row back is the reason they've essentially rowed back, and they did want to try and get some money from private schools, but essentially the reason they've rowed back is they've been told that they would have to redo a lot of redefinition and some primary legislation in terms of defining the charitable sector, those kinds of things. And the implications for everybody who is doing social work and support work in the community would be absolutely enormous. They can't stomach that. They can't do it. So actually, they're now talking about reclaiming money through abolishing VAT, which, interesting, they couldn't do when they were in the EU because the EU prohibits VAT being put on education costs. But now we're post-EU, we can do that. Mm. And I just think it's maybe another bit of relief for Christian leaders, something you don't need to worry about. I don't think churches are going to lose their charitable status. And perhaps they weren't anyway, but I think it's clearer now that they won't.
John, you got some wisdom in this area, being a lawyer by background. So,
briefly.
Yeah. Well, we do get
a little legal joke there. Do you see what I've done there?
I didn't get that. You had to explain it. Now I do. Yeah. Very funny. Yeah. And John, with your kind of legal background, churches do benefit from being charities. Things like gift aid is the obvious one, isn't it? And you can now claim gift aid on the plate donations that some churches pass around. So there are big advantages there. So it is a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, so I think I spent 16 years teaching charity law at universities and kind of wrote the textbook on it. So this is very much my kind of thing.
So briefly.
Yeah. It could be not very brief.
It's still for sale.
Please,
people still use
please.
It. It's actually really difficult to redefine charity because it goes back to the medieval period. It does.
Thank you.
But you can remove it. After the issues over kind of shootings, sort of shooting clubs had their charitable status removed. Mm. So that can be done. So it can happen. We benefit immensely from a sort of charitable status, which actually carries financial advantages. In fact, it is gift aid. It's worth remembering that extension of gift aid to all donations by taxpayers only really occurred when Gordon Brown was Chancellor. That's actually fairly recent. Before that, you had to enter into formal covenants to get that. But churches get a huge amount of effectively state subsidy.
Yeah, you don't pay tax on profits.
As a result of that.
Surfaces.
You don't pay tax on profits. And actually, the other really important thing is actually exemption on things like business rates on buildings. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's what's happening in private schools. There's at one level, charging sort of VAT on fees is that the parents who are there are basically being required to pay VAT on the service they're buying. That's one change. The other element would have been very significant costs for institutions if that charitable status were removed in terms of sort of rates they would have to pay, et cetera. So that will save them a huge amount. I don't think there's any suggestion at the moment that government is going to want to kind of remove charitable status from churches. I think we have to say it's not a right of religious freedom to have that. That's not guaranteed under the law, but it's so deeply embedded in our system, I can't imagine that would be sort of removed at this point. And actually, government is quite ambivalent towards religion. At one level, it would be secular, but at another level, it realises that religious organisations, including very large numbers of Christians, provide a huge amount of local social service. Mm-hmm. And actually, if they were to withdraw that effective charitable support, actually, they would lose all of what is being done in the community because it would simply be financially unsustainable. Mm-hmm. And I think, therefore, there's no real incentive for them to do that. When they actually looked at the costs and the implications, I would imagine they would think this would cause a massive sort of diminution in the ability to be able to care for people in the community. It would be a massive own goal.
Let's move on to talk about a story that's dominated the headlines the past couple of days. This is a conversation that happened on the television channel GB News. Mm. So Dan Wootton's show interviewing Lawrence Fox. Lawrence Fox made some extraordinary comments about one of the journalists of another channel, Ava Evans. I don't want to get into what was said and what was not said. We can agree it was a horrible thing to witness, and we would condemn it absolutely.
Well, not just a witness, a horrible thing to be said.
Yeah, well, indeed. Yeah, it's been doing the rounds on social media. People have watched it. It's unacceptable. But that's the question I really wanted to ask. You know, when does free speech, which GB News is all about, when does that move into the realms of unacceptable speech, which I think we can agree that this was?
Goodness, how long have you got? I don't think free speech is an absolute.
But it seems that some think it is.
Yeah, I mean, yes, some people do think it is. I mean, clearly as Christians, we don't think it's an absolute because there are times to restrain ourselves, times to be silent. There are times to speak kind words. Proverbs are clear that sometimes it's right not to speak. So actually, we have the freedom not to speak. That's part of our Christian heritage, I think. It's just worth saying on GB News, by the way, they are regulated by Ofcom.
Yeah.
So the question of what exactly constitutes Christian speech is slightly wrapped up in a broader question about broadcasting regulations in the UK and how companies are broadcast. And actually, they're going to be investigated by Ofcom over this. This is the 10th time they've been investigated, which gives the impression, really, that GB News are kind of pushing the boundaries all the time.
Sailing close to the wind, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's right. But I don't think freedom of speech is the freedom to deliberately cause offence and say offensive.
This was grossly offensive.
Absolutely.
Let's be clear.
That's
grossly
exactly right.
Offensive.
Exactly right. So I think more thought is needed. It's not simply you can say whatever you like, but clearly there do need to be boundaries, and there do need to be sometimes the boundaries are too drawn too sharply one way and sometimes too sharply the other way. I've read some time ago now a very interesting book by a guy called Timothy Garton Ash. Not a Christian, professor at Oxford on free speech. Very interesting. Basically making a case for free speech, but saying actually you do need to have boundaries. That's the only way you can operate in society. And actually the difficulty is knowing where those boundaries are drawn rather than whether you believe in free speech or not.
You don't get free speech anyway. So if you're on a jury, you can't talk about that outside of the things that are happening in a court. There's contempt of court. So our speech is limited in some ways by law.
I think that's right. But I think it's important to recognise it's in context. So I think free speech is really important. And the question is, you know, what can you say to your family? What can you say to your friends? What can you say in your pub? Are you limited in terms of what you can do there? And it's a very careful balance. So Lawrence Fox could presumably say what he wanted to say at Speaker's Corner, and he's perfectly entitled to exercise free speech there and then be held accountable for what he says. So, I, there is some speech that is unlawful because it's seen as being kind of stirring violence or hatred. So there are legal restrictions on speech that actually speaking in a way that causes that would be a criminal offence. And then there are other contexts in which you are not permitted to speak in that way. So the regulation of the media, you can't exercise complete freedom of speech on the media because of the perceived impact on the audience. Mm. So a right to free speech... It is at one level that the government cannot prevent you from saying things, but it can restrict, and social conventions will restrict the context in which you might say certain things because of the impact on others and the way that might be perceived. And that seems to me to be absolutely right. We can't expect to say absolutely anything in whatever way we want to, in whatever context, without thinking about the impact on other people. And I think that's really important for us as Christians. And I think we actually want to hold that balance. We want people to have the freedom to express their opinions. At the same time, we recognize that you've got to be very careful contextually as to whether that is appropriate because of the impact on others. And that's just a really difficult balance for us to work out. So some people have piled onto GB News because of this and said, you know, somehow GB News ought to be restricted. And actually they're attacking the kinds of opinions that GB News would have. I mean, GB News is a more right-wing sort of news outlet. I think there's a perfect place for that within the availability of media outlets. It's properly regulated. So we mustn't use free speech as a way of suppressing opinions and views that we don't want. But it is really important that those are not expressed in a way that's personally offensive to people. And here I think the very fact that sort of Lawrence Fox has been suspended, has demonstrated that this is an unacceptable way to speak, and he's experiencing the consequences of that.
And it's worth saying, in certain parts of the world, you all know where, the right of the absolute right of free speech has led, for example, to the availability of pornography. So it's not as simple as just saying you can say whatever you want. Actually, the same arguments are being used to defend all kinds of things that actually, as Christians, we have rightly have very strong views about.
It's important for Christian leaders to think about this, though, as well, because we do have an opportunity every week via the pulpit ministry to say whatever we want at one level. But we that's also in the right context, which needs to be restrained.
And we also, the Bible says a huge amount about speaking. Mm. So the Bible talks about how we need to speak the truth, how we need not to slander, how we need to be gentle in our speech, how we need to use our speech to benefit others and to build others up, not to knock them down. So actually there is an immense amount of biblical teaching about how we speak, the character behind our speech, the carefulness in the words that we choose, our sensitivity towards the person that we're speaking to. Again, you know, we see in the ministry of Jesus a real flexibility in the way that he speaks. He addresses people differently because he's aware of who he's speaking to. So the way Jesus speaks to Nicodemus is not the way he speaks to the woman at the well in Samaria. The way that Paul speaks to the Galatians is different from the way that he might speak in others of his letters, basically because he's contextually aware of the person that he's speaking to and adjusts the mode of speech in a way that benefits, edifies, and helps them.
Worth just very quickly giving a book plug. Carolyn Lacey, who's a women's worker in an FIC church, Wood Green in Worcester, has just written a book, Say the Right Thing, I think it's called, about speech. A short little book, but just capturing some of what the Bible talks about.
Great. We'll put the link in the notes. Just one very quick and finally, because time has gone. Adrian,
you've got a movie
to review.
Oh,
for
movie
us.
News.
Yeah.
Come on. Well, I love a Wes Anderson film, and the wonderful story of Henry Sugar, which is a Roald Dahl short story, has just been made into a new Wes Anderson film. I've not seen it yet. Came out of the cinema, was reviewed, I think, at the Cannes Film Festival. Got very high reviews, reviewed in the press this week, very high reviews. It's now streaming on a certain streaming website that many people have access to. And here's an interesting bit of information about it. It is 39 minutes long.
I mean, that is only just slightly longer than an episode of EastEnders.
EastEnders?
I went for Corrie, didn't I, beforehand?
Before you said Corrie. EastEnders, Corrie, whatever. That's right. I mean, it is a short story. What interests me about it is, films have got very bloated recently because people are sitting at home on their sofas. They can press pause. They can go to the loo, then go and get some, another beer or whatever. So films have got very, very bloated. Some films have even made it fill into 8-part series.
Which they should never be.
They should never be. So I just think it's very interesting. Just because you can make something long, you don't have to.
And lessons for church leaders?
Well, I think one of the great things about nonconformity is that people will sit through a longer sermon. You don't have to preach in 10 minutes. Churches will accommodate a longer sermon. And I remember being told if I was at one particular church, if I was preaching for less than an hour, shortchanging the church. But just because the church will allow you to preach for an hour doesn't mean you should. Sometimes, fellow preachers, less is more.
An excellent place.
John is preaching.
On Sunday afternoon.
That wasn't 39 minutes is my standard.
Yeah, very good.
That wasn't a goer, John. But I think for some of us, less is more.
Well, those who are preaching this weekend, go well. Brothers, thank you so much for talking with me in the news. This has been Independence, the FIEC podcast. Do rate, leave a review so others can find it, and we'll speak to you again very soon. Thanks, brothers.
Thank you.